So just to quickly review, this is our second sort of in a series of an introduction to tefillah. The discussion that we had last week, we first spoke about the fact that tefillah is not prayer. Prayer is really a Christian word. It means to beg. I am nothing. God is everything. I throw myself before the mercy of the court. Please change your mind. That seems to be Rav Kook's perspective. One of the fundamental questions of tefillah is how can you change God's mind? The simple response to that is you don't change God's mind, you change yourself. And of course the question is how does that work? We spoke about the fact that Yaakov on his deathbed says to Yosef, Ra'u fanecha lo pilalti. Rashi says, Lo milani libi lachshov ki arecha shuv. I never imagined, dreamed, wished, wanted to see you again. Lehit palel is the reflexive, something I do to and for myself. Right? Unculus and Rashi and Rishim Shaval Hirsch, when Rachel names her surrogate son Naphtali, even though that may be a different root nafol, not everybody agrees, so Unculus seems to say it's tefillah. Naphtule Elokim Niftalti, I've struggled the struggles of God. And therefore, if you put all of that together, Lehit Palel, to struggle with what I wish, with what I want, with what I could want. What do I want? Is what I want what I should want, what I could want? Right? How do I know what I should want? We spoke about the fact that wanting is a powerful energy, that Hashem created the world, at least the Hasidic idea, Hashem Tov, that Hashem created the world in such a way that in order for things to come into this world, we have to want them. Hashem wants to give to us, but we have to want what Hashem wants to give us. You can't give someone ratzon, right? Sometimes you so want someone to want something, and they don't want it. You know, you meet a person, you're madly in love with them, you so want them to want you, but they don't want you. And you can't give them that wanting. And when you're a parent, you get to a point where you sometimes so want your kids to want something, what they want is what they want. And what you want is who you are. And therefore, thinking about what you want and working on your wanting is a pretty important part of life. And that's really what tefillah is all about. So we're going to get into that a little deeper. Now, Rav Kook in his Olat HaRiyah, his introduction, has a couple of pieces that are worth discussing. And on the sheet that I gave you, it's labeled as number one. Okay, this is the opening of Rav Kook to tefillah, or at least this is how Rav Tzvi Yehuda felt, or where Rav Tzvi Yehuda, or Rav Kook's son, felt we should begin in our journey into tefillah. This is what he says. Okay? Hatfilah matmedet shel neshama. Okay? Let's talk about this from there. We have this perception. Right? Imagine that you go back to wherever, and someone asks you to teach their kid for a bar or bat mitzvah. Right? And you ask that kid, how many times a day do we daven? How many times a day are we mitpaleling? So we're going to use the word pray just because it's easier, but we've already discussed the fact that it's not really prayer. So how many times a day do you daven? How many times a day do you pray? So they'll tell you three times a day. Rav Kook says, that's incorrect. It's not that three times a day we daven. We're always in a state of tefillah. It's just that three times a day we succeed in tapping into that and getting out of the way to the extent that the tefillah is able to actualize itself. Now what does that mean? Right? Hatfilah matmedet shel neshama. So obviously one of the things that we have to do in order to understand this line, the constant state of tefillah of the neshama, is we have to understand what a neshama is. That's a little bit of a tall order, right? So I'm going to give you the short version, okay? We don't have a soul, right? I don't have a soul. I actually am a soul, right? Think about this. There are two aspects to who we are. There is the physical, and there is what we call the spiritual. Now, the physical is very simple. The physical is limited. Something is physical because it's limited. The Rambam and the Maor Nevuchim suggests that Hashem cannot be physical. Put aside, please, for the moment, the question of how Hashem cannot be anything. I know Benny's excited about that one. But put that aside for the moment, right? Hashem cannot be physical. The definition of that which is physical is that it's here and not there. This cup is physical because it's here and it's not there. That's what it means to be physical, right? Anything that is limited and that ends is physical. We are, to a certain extent, physical. We will all, Bezrat Hashem, ad mea ve'esrim, but we will all die. Because the aspect of us that is physical ends. Okay? But then there is that aspect of us that is spiritual. The capacity to love, to give, to reach out, to connect to Hashem. The neshama is the spiritual essence of us, It has no limits. But what is it? It actually is, according to Rav Kook. I am really oversimplifying here, so obviously you could spend years studying this topic, but just in order to have this discussion, the neshama is ratzon. The essence of the neshama is ratzon. When you tap into, when we tap into what we really want, what we really could want, when we experience our neshama, we're experiencing an aspect of Hashem. Now let's talk about two different things here, just briefly, so that we can get into this, okay? You know, sometimes you have a moment, and I don't know, you're at a wedding, and you see somebody getting married. You know, I remember last year, terrible story, Litwin and his son were murdered. You may remember the story in Othniel, just a few days before their daughter, Chaya, was supposed to get married. Friday afternoon, they were traveling to, I think, Meitar. They were supposed to be going for the Shabbat Chatan. Their daughter, Chaya, was back in Othniel, I think. I may be getting that wrong. You know, for Shabbat Kala, with all of her friends. They came around the turn in the bends, or maybe they were headed to Othniel. It doesn't really matter. Or at least for this moment, it doesn't really matter. And they were ambushed by a terrorist, and they were murdered. Now it's like a couple hours before Shabbat. She's experiencing a Shabbat Kala. She thinks she's getting married in a few days. Her father is now dead. Her brother is dead. She doesn't know yet. And they're trying to figure out what to do. So it's a complicated story, not for now. In the end, Rav Dov Lior paskins that they should get married as soon as they can, but they don't have to get married during the Shiva, which is an interesting debatable topic for another time. So they sit Shiva. They get up from the Shiva, and 5 days later they get married. And she, on the media, issues an invitation to all of Am Yisrael to come to the wedding. I imagine you remember this, right? They estimate there were 25,000 people came to this wedding. You go to a wedding like that, and, you know, she was in Binyan Eumah, you know. People thought we're going to just go in and see the Kala. You couldn't get in. There were 25,000 people. So somebody said to them, you know, 25,000 people came to be Mesamech. You have to go outside. So they came out, and the crowd went bananas. And it was such it's impossible to describe a moment like that. And there are people crying. And people are seeing this Chatan V'Kala, it's the happiest day of their lives, and it's the saddest day of their lives. And they don't know them, and they just start crying. Why does that happen? You stand in a Herzl on Yom HaZikaron, and somebody tells you a story. You go down to 1948 to the Chalkot, And you see an old woman and she's sitting there. I remember years ago. And, you know, you're never sure. Some of them really don't want to talk and some of them really do. So you go over and you say something like, did you know him? And then you see if they want to talk. And this woman starts sharing her story. She was engaged to this boy. And he was killed on the roads leading up to Yerushalayim. And she was broken because he was her fiancé. And eventually she found someone else and she got married, had children and grandchildren. But she never forgot her first love. And so every year in Yom HaZikaron, she goes back and spends a few hours on her own because who else will remember him? He never got married and he never had children. And you start talking, you don't know this woman. You certainly don't know this guy. And you start crying. How could you not cry? What is that? What is that? Something touched your neshama. What does it mean that something touched your neshama? A ratzon, a will, a wanting that is there, that is good, that is healthy, that is beautiful, that comes straight from Hashem, which may be covered up most of the time, gets uncovered. That's what that means. Now there's an interesting question, half of which we'll get to and half of which we won't, right? Which is, how do I know if what I want is really what I should want? You know, I don't know, you wake up in the morning, you want a cheeseburger. So that's easy. If you believe the Torah comes mishamayim, so then Hashem tells us, that's something. You may have a ratzon for that, but that's not what you should want. You're not wanting what I want you to want. So that's a wanting that you'd be better off not having. And we experience this all the time, you know. Who here has been a camp counselor? Any camp counselor? Right, you ever have that experience? You know that there's something that your chanichim, that your charges could want, and they don't want it. They don't want to wake up, or they don't want to go learn, or they don't want to have a sharing, or they don't want to go Kabbalat Shabbat. And they want something that you know is just not what, it's not ideally what you should want. It's not really going to grow you as a human being. How do you give them that one thing you can't? You can model for them what you could want. You can tell them what they could want. They have to discover that. Now, if lehit palel is to struggle with my ratzon, the neshama is in a constant state. The essence of who I am is in a constant state of wanting to reveal that. The me that is me, the essence of me, always wants whatever it is that the neshama wants. It's not like I start wanting it or I stop wanting it. It's always there. It's just that we kind of block it up, right? Now, one of the interesting questions there, of course, is how can I block me? How can you be the subject and the object of the same sentence? If you want to read, by the way, a really nice piece on this, Rabbi Aaron wrote a book called Endless Lights, based on a couple of different articles of Rav Kook. The book is based on more, but this particular piece, I think he calls it Me, Myself, and I haven't read it in a long time. And he basically asked this question. And it's really worth reading, a book called Endless Light. I'm sure it's in other of his books, but that's the one where I first saw it. And basically suggests that there are different aspects to me. There is me that is the character that I play, the role that I play. Like, Benny Friedman is a teacher and a rabbi, but that's not who I am. That's not who I am, that's just what I'm doing. Who am I really? Right? This is not me. This is just the physical aspect of me, but it's not me. Right? If this was me, you know, I'll tell you another amazing story. I was in we have a television upstairs in our bedroom. And hasn't been working for a while, but used to work. And you know, it's like the watch the news as you're getting dressed type of thing. And I come upstairs, I forgot something in my room, and I come upstairs, and it's like, I don't know, 8 o'clock in the morning, 8:30 in the morning, whatever, and we're usually, the TV usually is not, and if it's on, it's just the news, whatever, and I have to run to work, and I see my wife is sitting on the bed watching TV. Now, my wife works, she doesn't usually sit down at 8:30 in the morning to watch TV, or 8:15, or whatever it was, so I was a little surprised, and I started looking at what she was watching, and I couldn't walk out of the room. There was a fellow, you could only see his face. He was being interviewed by a woman whose voice you could hear, but you couldn't see her. And it becomes very apparent after just a moment of listening that he's describing a battle that he went through. What stopped me was that the face was totally not in sync with the words he was saying. He was describing, as it turns out, about the Battle of Binjbel, which was a battle in the Second Lebanon War. This was maybe a month after the Second Lebanon War, which is 10 years ago now. And he was describing the battle that he was through. I happen to know it was with Etzan Chanim. But he's smiling. It was very strange that he was describing this story and smiling. And there was something about him that I couldn't walk out the room. And he's talking about his story. And at one point, the woman asks him, after like a couple minutes, and she says, well, knowing what you know now, would you do it again? He looks at her and he says, Vadai, sure. And she says, knowing everything, knowing what would happen, you would still do it again. You would go and you would participate exactly as you did, knowing what would happen. And now the camera's panning out. And you see, it's not just him. He's sitting next to someone. She's got her hair covered. He's got a kippah on, so I'm assuming that they're married. Then you pan out a little further and you see he's sitting in a wheelchair. And then it pans out further and you see he has no legs. And he's still smiling. And this has to be fresh. This is a war that was like a month ago. He's got bandages on his stumps. And she's looking at him, this reporter that you can now see. And she says, if you would do this again? He looks at her, that's exactly what he said. He says, Tishmi, listen. She goes, obviously, I would love to have my legs back. Right? Vadai. But they're legs. Zelo mishani. They're just my legs. They're not me. I'm still here. And I'm still with my wife. And I'll still be able to bring up my children. And I'll be able to... It was mind-boggling. So, you know, the two of us were just like, bleh, you know, like bawling, whatever, right? Because that's a neshama moment. Right? This is not who I am. This is just the role that I'm playing. Who is the me that I really am? That's a neshama. And the character role that we play sometimes blocks up the essence of who I really am. And part of tefillah is about allowing that to be discovered. Allowing that impact to be felt. Now, what does that mean? So now we have to talk about what is Ratzon? What does it mean to have will? Where does will come from? I'll tell you an interesting thing. This is a little bit of a mystery. We don't know where Ratzon comes from. We only know that Hashem gives it to us, but we have no idea. You know, when my kids were little, so my daughter, I think I even mentioned this once, my daughter is, she's our eldest. She's the first grandchild on all sides, right? Both sides. She's the first great-grandchild. She had six adoring uncles when she was born. By the time she was 2 years old, she had so many toys, we didn't know what to do with them, right? Everything you can imagine. Barbies and books and toys and educational toys and non-educational toys. And it got to the point, like, you know, obviously they give her toys for present, and they come for Shabbos, they bring her toys, right? So I stopped giving them to her because I didn't think it was healthy even for a 1.5-year-old to be getting so many toys. So I said, oh, thank you so much, whatever, and then we put them away, and I figured. And then when my aunt was three, Yonatan was born. So I figured, this is great. I don't have to buy any toys because I got a stockpile. Now, this worked for about a year, year and a half. Somewhere along the line, Yonatan was not interested in playing with Barbie. He was not interested in the Happy Maker kitchen. He wanted trucks and bombs and G.I. Joes, whatever it was, horses, right? He wanted different things. Now, I don't think it was because we did something different to them environmentally, not at age 1.5. They have different ritzonot, right? If I have a chance to bring one of my kids so that we can do a kumzitz, I'd ask Yonatan to come, because he plays a wicked guitar. But if I gave my aunt a guitar, or a D, or Yair, and I said, you want to play guitar? They'd look at me and know what I'm talking about. Like, you know, to my aunt, a guitar is something you can use for firewood. Like, she has no interest in playing guitar. On the other hand, if I want a beautiful drawing, so maybe I'd ask my aunt to draw something. Yonatan, me, like, you know, we draw stick figures. Why is that? Because they have different ritzonot. Now, where does that ritzon, where does that will, where does that desire come from? That's a mystery. And I'll give you one example of how valuable an idea this is. There's a famous Gemara that I'm sure many of you have heard. The Gemara says, it eludes me right now exactly where it is. You can ask Rav Blau, he's bucking these things. But the Gemara says that if a person says, Yagati v'lo matzati, I struggled for it and I didn't succeed, don't believe it. Nobody ever really struggled for something without succeeding. If a person says, lo yagati v'matzati, I didn't struggle for it, but it worked, I got it, don't believe him either, right? Nothing good comes unless somebody struggles for it. Yagati umatzati, a person says, I struggled for it and I achieved it, shtabach shamo, that works. So Rav Dessler, right, you with me? So Rav Dessler in the Michta Meleah asks a great question. He says, wait a second, the verb is wrong. If the whole point of the Gemara is that yagati, when I struggle, I achieve, you shouldn't say matzati. You shouldn't say I found it. You should say I achieved it, I discovered it, I accomplished it. A metzia is something you don't work for. You're walking down the street and you find a $100 bill. It's a public domain, there's no one around. You didn't work for that. So Sister Dessler, when you work really hard and you accomplish something and you're so full of the notion that what you have in front of you is the result of all of your hard work, take a pause and ask yourself, what caused you to do all that hard work? That was your ratzon. Where did that ratzon, that desire, come from? That's a mystery. That's a gift. I remember when I went to Israel, and I had been in a base manager program in the Masifta and the Yeshiva High School I was in, and I got to Israel, I really wanted to see if I could fall in love with learning. I did not yet love learning. I also wanted to develop learning skills, but I wanted to fall in love with learning. Now, I had plenty of friends who came to Israel, and they did not want to fall in love with learning. That was not at all what they were interested in, and they did very different things. So you work really hard, and eventually you fall in love with learning. If you work at it long enough, you'll fall in love with learning. So then you start to pat yourself on the back, because look, I love learning now. But where did that desire to fall in love with learning come from? Like, why are you here? We're all here because all of us had a ratzon, a desire, a will to do something. Where did that come from? That's a gift. At its basest level, at its core, tefillah is the opportunity to struggle with what my ratzon really is. Because if I can figure out the ratzon, the will that Hashem gives me, then I can figure out what Hashem really wants of me to do. So tefillah at its basest level is a form of introspection. Now this does not mean that it's all about me. Because as I tap into my ratzon, as I tap into and experience my neshama, and I begin to connect with the ratzon that Hashem gives me, then inevitably, I end up developing a relationship with Hashem. Because I'm tapping into the ratzon Hashem has in me. Just like, you know, one day, God willing, when you get married, as you begin to understand what your partner wants of you, that's how you develop your relationship with him. So now we can go back to this line. Hatfilah matmedet shel neshama, the constant struggle to actualize the ratzon, that is the essence of who we are, the neshama, mitametzet itamid latzet min ha'alem el ha'gilui. It is constantly striving to be revealed, to burst forth from the hiddenness into the revealed. Al kol kochot ha'chaim shel kol ha'ruach v'ha'nefesh v'kol kochot chaya gviya kula. And this ratzon, as it is discovered and uncovered and bursts forth, it impacts everything. It changes everything. You ever walk into a room, you know, you experience as a teacher, but I'm sure you experience this in lots of different backgrounds. But sometimes, like, you know, come in to give a shiur, and, you know, people are sitting there and they have no ratzon. Now, we all know what a person looks like when he has no ratzon. He does not look like you. He looks like this. Right? Very hard to teach people who have no ratzon. Why? Because that energy, that lack of energy, it impacts the environment. Sometimes you walk into a room and it's full of people that have a lot of ratzon. They're motivated. And you catch the fire. You almost can't help but catch the fire. In fact, sometimes I'll get students, you know, we're recruiting, and they want to understand who it is that they're going to be with, right? And they're nervous, like, and they ask a legitimate question. Are people, let's say in this case in a raita, but it's true for any yeshiva, are they serious? Do they want to learn? Now, why does that matter? If I want to learn, and I'm sitting next to someone that doesn't want to learn, as long as he's a sensitive person, he's not telling me not to learn, because the energy of the people around us affect us, and our energy affects the world around us. And so that ratzon isn't just about me. The actualization of that ratzon changes the world. Right? He mishtokeket gamken legalot et ma'ota et plata al kol ha'sviva. And it yearns to impact the world around it. And Rav Kook goes on, just to finish this piece, right? U'l'shem kach tzichim anu l'chesh b'no shel olam sh'bal yedei Torah u'chokhma. So Rav Kook says, in order to really understand what ratzon is, you know, one of the questions you have is, how do I know my ratzon is a good ratzon? You know, let's say chas v'shalom, I don't know, a person is married and he has a ratzon for someone else. So that's problematic, right? Let's say a person has a ratzon to kill. That's problematic. How do I know that that's problematic? I have to tap into what it is Hashem wants of us. At some point, Hashem has to reveal what it is we could be wanting. Now, on one level, that's Torah, and mitzvot, and chokhmah, and everything else going on. And on another level, it's getting in touch with the ratzon that Hashem gives me. Okay? So that's the first piece. Before we go on, any questions? Does this make sense? Any questions? Cool? Okay? All right. Here comes the second piece. Okay? Ein hatfila ba'a ketikuna. This is an unbelievable one. Not only is Rav Kook giving you a perception, us a perception on tefillah, what he's saying is, if you don't get this idea, you can't daven properly. Now let's think about this for a minute. Okay? Why do you think that is? Does everybody understand what we just said? It's always dangerous to ask that. Want me to repeat it? Repeat it? Rav Kook says, tefillah cannot be properly experienced. It can't have the proper impact unless I understand that tefillah is coming from the idea of attempting to tap into Ratzon Hashem. Okay? Ein tefillah ba'a ketikuna ki mitoch ha'machshava shebemet ha'neshama yitamid mitpalel. If you don't understand that the neshama, soul, but that doesn't tell me anything, is in a constant state of tefillah, you cannot properly daven. Why is that? What do you think? Yeah?
The whole point is to tap into your ratzon. Your ratzon is supposed to be this developing a relationship with God. So that's what tefillah is, and you don't realize that you're trying to develop a relationship with God, and what you just were, because you're not tapping into that ratzon.
Okay. In other words, if I don't understand, if we don't understand that the ratzon that I'm trying to find is always there, and is always attempting to be realized, then I'm not getting the whole point of tefillah. You know? Let me ask you a question. You've all heard the phrase, to daven with kavana, right? So I remember once I was sitting with a couple boys from Yeshiva High School that will go nameless in America. And somehow we got into the topic of tefillah and tefillah in high school or whatever, right? And one of the boys was really getting into these series of discussions. He said, you know, I used to hate davening. In fact, I failed davening every year. So I look at him and I said, wait, run that by me again. You failed davening? He said, yeah, I failed davening. How could you fail davening? He said, what do you mean? I got a failing grade. I said, how do you grade someone who's davening? What does that mean, to grade someone's prayer? So the other boy looks at me and goes, well, what do you mean? What's the problem? We got grades for davening. I said, how do you grade davening? So they actually begin to describe to me the process of grading davening, right? Their grade was made up of three things. One was attendance, if you show up. And there's a difference, you get a point if you're there on time, if you're late, whatever. The other was whether you're participating. Because if you show up and you're there, but you're reading a book, even if it's a Rambam, so you're not davening, okay? And the third, which is the one that blew me the most away, was whether you're davening with kavana. Hey, whether you're davening with kavana, intent. So I said to him, well, how did they know, like, how did they even notice? Oh, there was a Rebbe, and he walked around with a clipboard. I said, nah, come on, you're kidding me, you're playing with me. No, really. He would daven beforehand. He didn't daven, although he came and told Phil, and then he would mark us. And this is a very respected yeshiva high school. So I said, well, how did he know if you were davening to kavana? So the guy looks at me and goes, well, what do you mean? I said, describe to me. Like, if I'm a Rebbe looking at you, describe to me what kavana looks like. What do you think he did? He shuckled and he closed his eyes. This is kavana. Right? If I'm listening to, what's the, we have a niggun that we do sometimes late night in the bass, right? Okay? It's really late. You look around, it's like 5, 6 guys. Sometimes somebody starts this niggun, you know, late night in the bass. Late night in the bass, right? So let's say you're hearing that in your head. And see. Right? So you're davening with kavanah. That's ridiculous! What does kavanah mean? So what does kavanah mean? Kavanah is from the word kivun, which means direction. In other words, in order for my tefillah to be tefillah, it has to be in the right direction. For example, if I think, according to Rav Kook, that I'm trying to change God's mind, which is what we mentioned, remember when we talked about Shevach, we talked about last week why we give praise to Hashem. And obviously you don't give praise to Hashem because Hashem needs our praise. We give praise to Hashem because we need to praise Hashem. But why do we need to praise Hashem? Because if I could really be in awe of Hashem, if I could really understand that Hashem is the source of all reality, I would realize how ridiculous it is that I'm trying to change God's mind. The point of Shevach, according to Rav Kook, is to get myself into a state of mind where I know that I'm not trying to change Hashem's mind. Shehi, Rav Kook says, de'a kozevet, because that's a false relationship with tefillah. And it corrupts your neshama. It messes you up. It prevents you from reaching wholeness and shlemut and totality and whatever else is going on. It's like a guy who's running on the train to get to Boston when the train is traveling to New York. You're going the wrong way. You're never going to get there. You can't daven with kavanah if you're not davening in the right kivun. And if Rav Kook believes that the right kivun, the right direction, is attempting to tap into what Hashem wants of me, if that's not what I'm trying to do, I'm not going to experience tefillah. Now, if I don't know that the neshama is in a constant state of tefillah, that the neshama is ratzon, and that it's attempting constantly, and that I'm tapping into my attempt to constantly struggle with what it is Hashem wants of me, if I don't get that, I can't daven. I'm not davening. And you don't have to go far. You can go lots of places in the Jewish world and find lots of people who daven this not davening type of davening. And it's not getting anywhere. Now, don't get me wrong. If a person doesn't get this and he's not there and he's going to shul, I'm not saying nothing is accomplished, and I'm not saying there aren't different opinions in looking at tefillah. But in Rav Kook's perception, that's exactly what he says. And when you stop to think about it, it makes a lot of sense. You know, anything in life that you want to accomplish, you got to know what your goal is. You have to decide, what's the point? What's the goal? What is it I'm trying to accomplish? You know, I've never done this because I think it would be too depressing. But I imagine if you went into the average shul, or the average yeshiva high school, whatever it might be. And by the way, just to be clear here, I'm not blaming the yeshiva high schools. This is not the yeshiva high school's fault. We have set up the yeshiva high school educational system to an intense degree. We've taken Torah, we've paralleled the secular studies, because we have to get into college. So secular studies, you have to have grades, you have to have papers, you have to have deadlines, you have to whatever. If you have Jewish studies without that, the kids don't take it seriously. So now you have to have Jewish studies with grades and papers and deadlines and fails and passes and whatever else is going on, right? And because they have to somehow do both of these things, they only get a half a day or half the amount of time. I'm not even talking about schools that have like 2 hours of Jewish studies a day. Who on earth could give a proper experience of tefillah and Jewish study in that environment? That's not the yeshiva high school's problem. Yeshiva high schools would love to do it the way it's supposed to be done, but the communities would never go for that, and that this is a communal issue. So I don't want anybody to interpret chas shalom that I'm judging yeshiva high schools or communities. It's a complex issue that we struggle with in our modern world, and fine. But in terms of what the result of our challenge is, that's the result. If you walk up to a shul, and people are walking into the shul, says, tell me, sir, can I ask you what your goal is this morning? Like, what's your goal? You're walking into Dhani, what's your goal? I would be willing to venture 90% of the people have no clue how to answer that question. 9% more, I'm not sure that if they have even thought about it or come up with an answer, that it's what... But now let me ask you, now that we're having this discussion. So, you know, we'll daven Maariv, or we'll wake up tomorrow and daven Shacharit. And we'll enter the world of tefillah. What is our goal? What do you think? That's exactly right. What is it Hashem wants of me? What does Hashem want of me? Now, by the way, it's interesting, because you can divide this into different areas. How many areas of what does Hashem want of me do we have? 13. There are 3 brachot of Shevach, right? Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov at the beginning of the Shemoneh Esrei, at the beginning of the 18, now 19, benediction prayer, the silent Amidah, which we'll get to. And then there are 3 tefillot, 3 brachot at the end, right? Modim anachnu lach, ya'al kulam, sim shalom. And then there's that fat piece in the middle, the 13 brachot of, what do we call them? Bakasha. Now, we may or may not get to this, because we only have a summer, we don't have a whole year, but bakasha, in Rav Kook's lens, is not me asking God to see if I can get it. Bakasha in Rav Kook's lens is, these are the things I should want. And if you can go a day without genuinely wanting that people who are ill should get better, something's wrong. If you can go a day without genuinely wanting that the Beit HaMikdash should be built, that there should be a place where we can experience the presence of Hashem, where Jews can put aside their differences and come together, where the world, right, Amim Har Yavo, where the world can come and see reality as it's meant to be seen. If we don't genuinely want that better world, then something's wrong with us. And so on and so forth. But the root of it is, what do I want? And this brings us back to something we mentioned, but here it becomes pretty obvious. There are 3 basic questions. I'm going to keep repeating this mantra. There are 3 basic questions that a person is meant to ask themselves in every moment of every day, but certainly when we daven. What do I want? Why do I want it? Do I think Hashem wants me to want this? Right? I don't know. You meet a guy or a girl, and they're amazing. And you start asking yourself, what do I really want? You know, maybe they're not Jewish. Maybe you want to stay in Israel, and they're going off to, I don't know, dig for oil in Alaska for the next 15 years. And so you got to ask them, what do I want? What do I want? You know, you graduate college, and you're like, do I stay in America, or do I go to Israel? Do I get the job, go for the guy, take a year off, do Shirut Lumi, learn Torah? What do I want? Let's say you actually figure out what you think you want. Then comes the next question, why do I want it? You know? Every once in a while I'll get a student and he says he really wants to go to the army. If it's at the beginning of the year, I'm like, okay, you know, we'll get to talk about it, right? And sometimes they want a good thing, but they don't want it for the right reasons. There's a phrase in the Israeli army, it's called wasach. Wasach is like, pardon? Swag, I guess. It's walking down Ben Yehuda on a Saturday night with your red beret and your wings. Okay? It's, I don't know, cool. That lasts about 60 seconds. It's not worth the 2 or 3 weeks of hell every time you finish your weekend off. Right? So if that's the only reason the person wants to go to the army, they're in for a very rough ride. That's not the right reason to go to the army. Just like you don't go to medical school so that one day you can wear a smock and look cool. That makes you not a doctor, but an idiot. Right? And that doesn't mean there's anything wrong with sort of taking a little pleasure in that moment, I suppose, but that's not why you do things. So there's what do I want, and then there's why do I want it. And, you know, sometimes you can figure this out quickly. Sometimes this is a journey. Sometimes you think you get it, and then you go back and you realize you didn't get it. You know? And then you get to that third question, was, do I really think Hashem wants me to want this? You know? We've all had, I remember about 10 years ago, before we started Right Down, I got this amazing job offer. They wanted me to direct Birthright follow-up, right? Which is a big deal. And, you know, you have like 100, 150,000, now it's like 250,000 students. And is there enough follow-up, and could you make a difference, and what a big thing, what could you do? But this was right around the time that we were talking about starting Oraita. And I really didn't know what to do. I was talking to Rabbi Aaron, to his credit, said like we were partners. Rav Blau wasn't here yet. This was just a dream, right? And there were three of us, Rabbi Aaron, Rav Moshe, who I don't think you've met, and myself. And Rav Aaron said, look, you know, I can't tell you not to do that. Like, that's, like, you might change the world. But I can tell you one thing for sure. I'm not going to start a right there if you're not doing this, because I'm not banking to do this on my own. So now that's a really big question. Like, what do I want to do? It was very difficult. It took me months. I went for walks. I got into my davening in ways that... I remember one day, here, I was up here on the roof, and opened my eyes after Shemoneh Esrei, and like everybody was gone. Because I got so into this question. It's in the middle of a tefillah. Right? You're dating someone, and you don't know who they are. Tachonen ladam dat. You give us dat. Vayeda adam et chava ishto. Adam knew Eve in the biblical sense, and she got pregnant and gave birth. The ability to develop relationships, the wisdom to understand relationships. That's what that is. That's the point in the day when you can take a pause and struggle with, what do I really want? Right? Now, I don't know about you. If I tried to do this for all 19 brachot, not to mention all the pieces of brachot, Kriyat Shema and Shevach, and the different ideas that are there every day, I'd be the option of a Rebbe. I'd be sitting till, 3 in the afternoon davening shachris. I wouldn't get anything done. Which doesn't mean that that's the wrong way to go, but you make a decision whether that's who you want to be. So I can't do this every day. I can't do this with all the brachot every day. But what I personally do, there are different ways to do this, is I pick one bracha every week. And this week, that's the bracha I'm working on. And the other brachot I say, more or less, there's a moment where I think of an idea, but And one bracha I really take a little time to focus on. And what's interesting is, you go through a cycle every 3 months. So now that you've been doing this for 20 years, 30 years, so... the brachot that you're not focused on are in a different place than when you weren't focusing on 30 years ago. And there may be other ways to accomplish this. But that's what Rav Kook is talking about. Can I tap into the ratzon that Hashem gives me? Do I recognize that tefillah is all about struggling with what does Hashem want of me? And here are the 13 areas. And by the way, why did the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, that incredible body of individuals, why did they do this? Why did they either create or edit or write down the Shemoneh Esrei? Because they realized we'd lost touch with what we could want. After 70 years of exile in Bavel, we had lost touch with what we could want. Think about Russia, right? The communist revolution occurs in 1917. Glasnost and the fall of the Iron Curtain is pretty much 87, 70 years. Look what happened to the Russian Jewish community in 70 years. Look what they lost. That was Bavel. They came up to Yerushalayim, only 50,000 of them, the rest of them stayed in Bavel. We know what happened to them. They kind of eventually disappeared, right? There's a little food for thought about America, but I'm not going to go there right now. So 50,000 Jews come back here, and Ezra comes up later, right? Or Ezra comes up with those 50,000, maybe 120,000 Jews here, with Zerubbabel and Nehemiah. And he discovers a Jewish population that is bereft of Torah and Mitzvah. Kohanim are intermarrying. People forgot what Shabbat is. They forgot what Kashrut is. So one of the things that they do, and you can look at in Sefer Ezra and Nehemiah, what these Anshei Knesset HaGedolah do, and understand what the key components of Jewish life are according to the Navi. But one of the things they do is they put together the Shemoneh Esrei, because there's a list of what we could want. We've forgotten what we could want. That's the second piece. That's the foundation. And now I understand the third piece. Let me just read this really quickly. Hatfilah mivakeshet. Well, you know what? Let me just finish the second piece, right? Because it's so beautiful. Halohi afal mitrapeket al todah below shum hefsek klal. It flies. When you release the neshama, when you uncover it, when the ratzon comes free. Have you ever had an experience like that? Where you don't know what you want, and you finally figured out what you want? And it's this awesome feeling. I figured out what I want to do. Even if it's difficult. Even if you're choosing a path that's difficult. When you really know what it is you want, and you really believe that Hashem wants you to do this. I can remember moments in the army or in other places where the path that you believe Hashem is choosing for you is very difficult. But it's an awesome feeling because you really believe that what you're doing in that moment is what Hashem wants you to do. Right? When I'm actually in the process of tefillah, the ratzon, the tefillah, the soul tefillah, that's always there, is finally revealed. This is its beauty, its pleasure. Hadara v'tifarta, its magnificence. Shel tefillah. Shehi mitdame l'shoshana. Hapotachat et alea hana'im likrat atal. Onochach karnei ha'shemesh. Tefillah is like a rose whose petals open before the rays of the sun or the dew in the morning. Right? Just like you see sometimes people and you meet them and they're so stuck. They're so closed. They're so covered up. And then they go through this journey and they begin to discover who they really are and what they really could want. And it's like the rose petals open up. It's unbelievable. You know? V'lachen, Halavai sheitpalel adam kol hayom kulo. Gemara in Brachos. I remember the first time I saw this Gemara. Gemara says, would that a person would daven all day. It's Gemara in Brachos. I remember the first time I saw this Gemara. I'm like, daven all day? Seriously? Are you kidding me? But that's exactly who we're supposed to be. We're supposed to be in a constant state of tefillah. Can you imagine a moment in your life when you wouldn't want to be struggling with what you really want and what Hashem really wants of you and why you really want it? Tefillah is just this opportunity to reconnect to what I should be doing all the time. It's this incredible recipe that the Torah gives us, right? Okay, so we have to stop here because I can't do the next piece in more than in a minute, and I don't want to keep our plow waiting. So let's pause here. Any questions? Yes. Yeah.
The third part of it, like the third question goes back to yourself, but I think that Hashem wants me to want it.
Yeah.
I don't understand how you can answer that question. Is that a lifelong struggle? Like once you're within the realm of halacha, because it's outside halacha, so okay, Hashem doesn't want me to want it. Once you're within halacha, how can you ever know if Hashem wants you to want it?
So I'll give you a short version, because I'm afraid I'll forget to do this next time. It's an excellent question. How do I know what Hashem wants me to want? So there are two types of questions. There's one type of question where it's easy. Like you say, the halacha tells me, right? If, I find out that the person's really my sister, halacha tells me I can't marry her, much as I want it. Okay, at least I know what the answer is. Now I have to struggle with how to deal with the question. Okay. But what do you do when you have a question in life where you really don't know, and the halacha doesn't tell you? You're not sure if you want to be a lawyer or a doctor. The halacha doesn't tell you. So there's an amazing piece by the Vilna Gaon, the Evan Shlaim, and he says, he asked this question basically, what to do and how to answer the question of what it is I should be doing when I don't know what to do. Well, we have questions like this. And he has three different approaches. One is, and I once heard a phenomenal shiur by Ezra Bick from Gush on this topic. If you look for it on Gush's website, maybe it's up there somewhere. This was like 30 years ago. So one of them is the Goral Agra. It's this mystical way of concluding and getting answers to your questions that really is beyond the scope of my understanding and our abilities, most probably, unless there's someone here who's really amazing that we don't know yet. He has a second response, which is learn Lishma for 6 hours. If you learn Torah, this is the Vilna Gaon. This is if you learn Torah Lishma for its own sake, for 6 hours straight, you will get the answer to your question. Now, the problem with this is... Oh, exactly. You have to then learn Torah, and you have to forget about your question. If you learn Torah for your question, it's not Lishma. So you have to learn Torah without any desire to get the answer to your question. I actually had a very difficult question I was struggling with when I happened to come across this Gra. I think I was Shana Bep, maybe I was Shana Hay, I don't remember. And I tried this for 3 days. It is remarkably difficult to learn straight for 6 hours, never mind learn Lishma. I mean, like, if you have a thought, you blew it. If somebody interrupts you, you blew it. I gave up after 3 days. It was still worth it. I got a lot of 3 days, but whatever. But then he has a third answer, and this is amazing. He says basically there are two aspects to every question. There is an objectively right decision. You are either more suited to be a lawyer or more suited to be a doctor. The example of Bick gave, if I recall correctly, is you're invited to a bar mitzvah and a wedding. The bar mitzvah is in the Eilat, and the wedding's in the Golan. You can't go to both. Objectively speaking, if Hashem was to put together all the different factors, how much this person would appreciate you being there, how much that person, where you spend more gas, all the different factors, you would come up with an objective answer. But you don't know what the objective answer is. So one aspect is the objectively correct answer. There's a second aspect. The second aspect is, why would I go to the wedding of the bar mitzvah? Says the Vilna Gaon, I'm paraphrasing, if you make the wrong decision, but you make it for the right reasons, it'll end up being the right decision. If you make the right decision and you make it for the wrong reasons, it'll end up being the wrong decision. So make sure when you make your decision, you're making it for the right reasons. If you go to the bar mitzvah, or you go to the wedding because you think they're going to, I don't know, give you a bracha under the chuppah, it's going to look good, that's the wrong reason to go to a wedding. Yuck. Right? But if you go to the wedding because she's an orphan girl and you really feel it can make a difference in life and you purely want to be sameach chatan v'kala, even if objectively you should have gone to the bar mitzvah, it'll end up being the right reason. So that's as close as we're going to get with the amount of time we have. A little food for thought. We will continue this journey next week. Shkoyach, everybody. Thank you. No problem.